Okay, so I'm here with David Shields, who is most recently the author of Reality Hunger. David, how are you doing?
Just fine. Thank you, Edward. Yeah, okay. It's great to be here on Bat Segundo.
Let's start with the beginning of the novel. I think that's pretty appropriate. You write, the origin point of the novel lies in the pretense of actuality. You point to Defoe and Fielding's efforts to suggest real accounts. But I'm wondering if any effort to offer a pretense of actuality in our present age, whether it's through a remix or a collage, really represents an inevitable return to this antediluvian form, this pretense of actuality.
Exactly. I'm going to see if I can find this wonderful quote by Adam Gopnik in the book, and maybe you can help me find it. But he basically says that the only kind... I've been trying to find it of late, so I think it's... I'll see if I can find it, but... Sorry, Beth. No, I got it. But,
You didn't memorize all 600?
No, I've memorized most of them, but it's, see if you can find a Gopnik. But anyway, there's this incredible passage by Gopnik who says the only kind of work that can move us is work that is full of a kind of gallows humor and above all has an authentic disorder. I think he's talking about Francis Bacon. I'm not sure what, but perhaps later we'll find it. But I think that's right, that's in a way you've cut to the core of it, and Gopnik has, and I hope I have, which is any such gesture. Like, for instance, I must admit, I was looking at the Knopf catalog. You know, I visited the Knopf office, and they send you home with a catalog. That's their big gift to you. And I'm looking at some of the books describe various mainstream novels, and I'm just thinking, you cannot be serious. In 2010, you're publishing this book by this person. It seemed like such an unbelievably antebellum thing. It's like, you can't, I mean, it's like, what does this possibly have to do with life lived at the ground right now? It just seemed absolutely preposterous. I started just bursting out in laughter. So it's just sort of...
Well, such as what, exactly?
Well, the book that was being described, and no offense to her, I haven't read her work, but it was a book by somebody named Myla Goldberg. Do I have her name right?
Yeah.
And my God, talk about a formulaic text with, you know, these little plot points. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
You know, with these little plot points everywhere. Just some more water when you have a moment. And it was like, I don't know what, it was just like, you know, probably an intelligent, well-meaning, well-read writer. It's like, wow, this is so, you might as well be writing the most sort of formulaic sitcoms. And, you know, and she's a respected, and I think somewhat respected, somewhat commercially successful writer.
But you're also...
You know, and I was like, anyway, this is a long-winded answer of saying,
yeah,
you've cut to it. Any such gesture now strikes me as antediluvian indeed. Absolutely. Yeah.
But you're also judging this not on the book, but on the description of the book. So therefore, we get into a meta territory here. I mean, how can you make a judgment based off of a catalog description? If I did that, then I would probably avoid most books because they're often written in this corporate copy.
Of course. But, I mean, I've read enough of her other books. I flipped pages to realize that catalog copy was all too relevant to the book. And also, I love the line of Borges in the book where he says, you know, where he says something like, why write the book? Let's just write the commentary of the book. The book can be summarized in 10 sentences. Let's write the meta-commentary and cut to the, you know, the point. So the meta-commentary interests me at least as much as the text itself. So that's not, I mean, in this case, it did not seem to be doing a disservice to the book.
Even though you haven't actually flipped through the book.
Well, I've read in and around her earlier books, and it seemed, the way in which the book could entirely be summarized as a narrative machine seemed to me that very fact meant it was by definition, for me, a dead text. I mean, there wasn't a single thing discussed, but this happened, then that happened, then this happened, then that happened. I mean, you might as well had... It was just really embarrassing. It was embarrassing to read.
Embarrassed? You felt embarrassed?
I felt embarrassed that I was part of... I mean, I think it was a Doubleday book. I was embarrassed that I was at a publisher that had a relationship to that. It was like, what does this have to do with the advancement of culture? You know, nothing.
Well, I want to actually ask you about one creative aspect that you only broach briefly in the book, and that is the creative possibilities that come from mishearing things. Don DeLillo wrote the early sections of Falling Man after deliberately mishearing specific things. And in fact, you allude to when you first heard about Sherman's March. You say that you heard someone tell you, the first film I've ever seen in which I recognized the South in which I lived, but South had been replaced by Self.
Uh-huh.
Had you not misheard that, you may not have seen this film that has become a very important part of I think, your argument in this book and also your creative output. So the question I have is how mishearing something relates to this larger argument about the mutability of text and the mutability of reality.
Well, first of all, I may not have made sufficiently clear, or maybe you misheard the text, but I went to school on McAwee's Sherman's March the moment it came out in 1988 or 87. Whereas I heard this line relatively recently, where I've watched that film probably 50 times. So, I mean, I know that film backwards and forwards. Then I happened to be at Breadloaf a few years ago, and someone was talking about it, and I thought it was a very funny line. But earlier in the text, I say how, when I was writing my fourth book, Remote, how influential Sherman's March was on me. So, there's an extra layer here of mishearing in which, for whatever reason, you interpreted what I said as meaning that's how I found the text. In fact, you know, I've been going to school on that film for 30 years. But that being said, the mishearing is vital. I mean, I'm in a way, this whole book, in a way, is an odd ode to Bloom's anxiety of influence with a little bit of Lethem's ecstasy of influence, in the sense that that's all that writers... I think it's a very beautiful and moving theory of Bloom's that's what writers do, that to say Milton misreads the Bible and writes Paradise Lost, Shelley misreads Milton and writes Prometheus Unbound, Roth, you could argue, misreads Shelley and writes Zuckerman Unbound or whatever. That's all that it is, that we, you know, Stevens misreads, you know, whoever. Stevens misreads, you know, Whitman and writes, you know, Sunday Morning. Whatever the example is, that's so much of what the writerly gesture is for me. I mean, I think the mishearing is everything, and you know, and misreading is everything. That's the creative act. I mean, I'm so much more interested in people's misreadings than I am in any kind of sober reading. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much of this book is me misreading people, decontextualizing them and recontextualizing them so that they form part of my argument. So I'm almost either intentionally or unintentionally or something, I'm misreading them pretty much line for line.
So you would say that a greater creative purity or a greater novel would possibly come from mishearings or misunderstandings or misappropriation?
Well, I don't know about a novel. I mean, yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, a greater... Say again, please. I mean...
Well, I'm just wondering if a truer creative impulse comes from misappropriation, mishearing, context that just snaps in the brain and turns into something totally different, that this is part of the mutability of reality here.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're basically are revisiting what we said a moment ago, I think. But I can just give endless numbers of examples, but I think of, you know, I guess for me it's sort of tradition of the individual talent, that I'm not a critic, I'm not a scholar, I'm trying to be an actively producing and useful writer who alters the arc of the culture in some way. And so I would say I'm trying to give who am I to give anyone permission, but I'm urging people to see this amazing web and digital and literary culture we have available to us at our fingertips, and to remix to our heart's content, take Audacity of Hope and flip it so that there's this endless remaking. And so, yeah, I mean, I would just sort of reiterate what I said before and definitely agree with you that the irony being is that I don't think that one consciously misappropriates. you have to be in this sort of trance-like state in which you really think you are reading. Like, for instance, I read, say, David Markson on my own very specific terms, and Markson totally disagrees with how I read him. But it's like, I don't care. I found him an amazingly useful writer for myself, and out of him grows me. If I were to read Markson on Markson's own terms, I'm Markson. I want to reread everyone on my own terms that generates work for me. Work for me is precisely misreading. A writer is a reader moved to imitate, and the more that you misread, the more you create space for yourself to produce your own work. So I guess I'm, you know, the perceiver by his very presence alters what's perceived. That's pretty much rule one of any post-Heisenbergian world that we occupy, and, you know, welcome to the Thunderdome is my flag.
Okay. But on the other hand, if the terms are individual and they're also general, how is there a common reality, or are the terms just subject to change as to how one receives a novel or writes a novel? I mean, this book is essentially what forms the center between you and I right now. I've just met you. I mean, this is the prism right here. I mean,
right.
But on the other hand, my mind and your mind are entirely different.
Right.
So as a result, the question is whether, you know, if the terms are in subject to constant fluctuation, where is the point? Where are the points of agreement? And does the mutability even matter? Because everything's going to be shuffled up anyway,
uh-huh.
And it's all down to on a subjective level.
Yeah, and therefore what? This is the mutability cantos. I mean, that there is no, I mean, all is flux. There is no reality. I mean, the reality hunger here is meant to be in quadruple quotation marks. I don't have any unique access to reality that you don't have. I mean, I just feel like, I really like the three epigraphs, the way they work together to gather these themes. You know, in the next edition of the book, I'm going to flip the order of the epigraphs, in the sense that the first epigraph ought to be, in my view, all great works of literature either dissolve a genre or invent one, from Walter Benjamin. And then Picasso's Artist Theft, and then Graham Greene saying, when we are not sure we're alive. I mean, that to me is the argument of the book. I want to bend and bury and blur genre. I want to embody it through deactivating the sources of my quote so that the reader experiences on a visceral level the theoretical stuff I'm talking about genre. And then the ultimate goal for me is to get the reader into a state of sort of vertiginous doubt, into a sense of existential uncertainty, so that he or she is feeling the ground shift underneath them. Who's talking here? Sonny Rollins, Schopenhauer, Shield, some weird remix? What genre are we in? Confession, literary criticism, polemic, stand-up comedy, plagiarism? There's where we're getting interesting, because we can't touch terra firma. And so, yeah, I mean, it's all is mutability, absolutely.
So really, if the ground is constantly shifting, that's all that really matters here.
I don't know if it's all that really matters, but it's a key part of my argument is to espouse and try to embody work that is true to human consciousness, human existence, and especially human consciousness and human existence in 2010 in Western civilization. I mean, we live in a culture of, you know, virtually constant stimulation and flux. And so to write, say, you know, take an easy target, a Milo Goldberg novel seems to me, you know, you might as well be selling, you know, gold doubloons or something, you know. I mean, it has about as much relevance to the culture.
You bring up the lyrical essay. You note that it's the literary form that gives the writer the best opportunity for rigorous investigation because its theater is the word and offers no consoling dream world, no exit door. But I must ask, what's so wrong about dream worlds? They're not always so comforting. I mean, Blindness by Jose Saramago, William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. These are very disturbing dream worlds. And as to the exit door, Well, I can rattle off numerous lines. I mean, Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow. Now everybody. William Gaddis' J.R. So, I mean, listen, I got this neat idea. Hey, you listening? Hey, you listening? There isn't necessarily a resolution once one reaches the exit door. So I'm curious as to why those particular forms are more verboten, particularly the dream world and this final door.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, basically, I would say on some level, finally, you know, sort of different strokes for different folks. If you like those novels, fine. You know, if you don't want to have it, if you're against abortions, don't have one. Like, finally, you know, I'm not going to prevent you from reading J.R. if you want. I mean, finally, this is my take. I'm trying to stay alive as a writer. I'm trying to bring along as many fellow travelers as I possibly can. The art of nonfiction has been insufficiently articulated until now, and whereas the history of the novel and the history of the poem have had a poetics for millennia. Having said all that, the dream world does sort of bore me in the sense that when you make a gesture of nonfiction, I'm really interested in the word non. I love, to me, in the very best nonfiction, when you can define nonfiction upward. I mean, if you define nonfiction downward, it's this incredibly banal form, a vetted article in the newspaper or scholarship where everything is cited. But to me, in the very best nonfiction, the hundreds of books I cite in my book, the very frame of nonfiction is a frame to foreground contemplation. And specifically, the very fact that we're trying to get at something, quote, real, forces the very best writers, the most philosophically inclined writers, to ask things like, you know, what's real? What is knowledge? What's memory? What's a self? And there's actually, to me, a nervous-making, risk-taking mechanism. Like, the writer is actually gesturing toward, you know, a self that's quote-unquote real. And that, basically, I really hate the escape door that so many writers have, whereby a novelist says, you know, perhaps writes about a very unpleasant narrator and says, well, finally, there's always that exit door. It's not me. You know, Humbert is this guy out there. I mean, I think that Lolita is an interesting test case because, to me, it's a really bad novel. I mean, it doesn't hold up at all. I mean, have you ever tried to reread Lolita as an adult?
I reread it about 5 years ago. I loved it.
Really?
Yeah.
It's really bad, I think. You know, I mean, I think it's so smug. It's so sure of itself. It has no real desire. The prose is this god-awful, purple, alliterative junk. It's terribly full of condescension toward everything. It has no real nervousness to it. You know, it has no real risk-taking. It's terribly self-congratulatory. I mean, to me, it's
Humbert is a smug, self-congratulatory person. Therefore, the prose must reflect that particular perspective to some degree.
I mean, people argue that, I mean, I just think the game, what happens in so many dream worlds is the game isn't worth the candle. That finally one says, like, okay, that's fascinating. To me, Nabokov does not have, I mean, he doesn't have, in my view, either sufficient closeness or sufficient distance toward Humbert. It's an amazingly masturbatory book, but without any of the interesting smells and sounds and textures of masturbation. I mean, it's an incredibly self-enclosed world, and to me, it's just a really dead novel. Like, to me, the preface interests me more. Alfred Appel's annotated Nabokov interests me. I'm terribly interested in marginal text. I'm terribly interested in scribbling on the monuments. The monuments bore me. The one of the lines in the book I like, I say, no more masters, no more masterpieces. It seems like a really dead modernist gesture where we're supposed to worship at the altar of, you know, Nabokov or Gaddis or whatever. I mean, I don't know. I don't. Those books don't interest me. The books I love are books that are much smaller and much more focused, much more visceral and naked. There's less mediation between the author and experience. And I could list for you hundreds of such books. They tend not to be called, to me, Gravity's Rainbow and J.R. I mean, I can read those books, and I've read those books, and they're they've had their moment. We live in a different moment in which those kinds of novelistic monuments seem to me not what we need most passionately. I mean, at least not what I need, and to the degree that this book is striking a chord, other people seem to agree, or they disagree, I guess.
Do you like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones, or are they just absolute rubbish?
I really like the Grey album. I like Danger Mouse's remix of the Beatles. I mean, but I'm not interested in War Horses. I mean, how many times can you listen to Beethoven's Fifth? I don't want to see King Lear performed straight. If you wanted to do King Lear and remix it in some interesting way, culture like science moves forward. You know, art like science moves forward. We have discovered the theory of relativity. There's no point in endlessly proving the theory of relativity. We move beyond it. Art advances, and to endlessly worship the, you know, the documents of the past is not the way art renews itself. And my book is an attempt to offer some ways out of what seems to me like the oxygenless nature of contemporary literary culture, which is completely lost, where it worships novels that in no way merit our worship, you know.
I wanted to ask you about plot, since we're on the subject. You write, plot is a way to stage and dramatize reality, but when the presentation is too obviously formulaic, as it often is, the reality is perceived as false. But I would counter-argue that one reads books differently. I mean, you may perhaps be too attuned to a particular plot, but if I were to quibble with belabored plot, like, say, in a mammoth book like Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon, I would totally avoid the wonderful Captain Crunch segment of that book. Likewise, for American Psycho, the little perspectives that Patrick Bateman brings on Huey Lewis and Genesis are interesting, perhaps even more interesting than the rest of the book, which is, you know, a collection of brand names, but I still find it, the whole, quite interesting. But if I were concerned about plot, and if I were to subscribe to that definition, I wouldn't be able to enjoy these books. And I also don't think that people necessarily read with a formulaic structure in mind. So is it really a scenario where when you read a book, you get so caught up in this, in what is considered formula, that you're unable to, like, find these fresh perspectives along lines of some of the examples I just raised right there? Or?
I do, but, I mean, of course I find those little aperçus, these little sort of frissons where things explode for a minute. But what I find in my actual reading experience, trying to clear away all the praise that accrues to certain work. For instance, for some reason, I think of, as an example, Bellow's novel Herzog, which a lot of people really love. And there are some amazing observations in it, but they occur, I would say, about every 35 pages. It's like boring, 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 boring. Hey, that's a good insight. Boring. That's the feel of the book. It's the feel of an awful lot of novels for me. It's like, really, that you needed 700 pages to get to that insight? I'm very aware of the fact that we're mortal. I'm very aware of the fact that we're existentially alone. That I can't know what you're thinking and feeling, and you can't know what I'm thinking and feeling. And the best bridge that we can construct across that abyss is unbelievably serious and great writing. It is the very best bridge between human beings. And for me, I find deeply unserious a lot of works that to me are paying a kind of middle-class, middle-brow homage to the reader. And then they sneak in their little insights now and then to remind themselves that they're literary texts. But really, the motor of the work is to get the reader to turn pages. And that every so often, there's an insight, either by metaphor or trope, image, or actual observation. But the energy of the work is essentially a commercial impulse to get the reader to keep on turning pages. And I feel like that's for children, frankly. That's not adult activity. It's not for people who are trying to understand existence better. It seems to me frivolous and an amazing example of the game not being worth the candle. So I just find that in my actual experience of supposedly good novels, time and time and time and time again, that the power to weight ratio is way off. Given how much the book weighs, the power it delivers is infinitesimal.
But don't you need to give the reader a carrot to get to the insights of page-turning a book? I mean, one might argue that as well. I mean, that you know, something like, for example, the works of Volman, which you start off with The Royal Family, for example, and it's this pulp novel, essentially. And then we get into these prolific observations about the Tenderloin neighborhood and about the prostitutes that inhabit it. Nobody else is working that territory nearly as prodigiously as Volman. And the same would go for numerous other writers like Madison Smart Bell or Richard Powers or someone along those lines. I mean, is there no place for, I guess, information within books if you give the reader a carrot in terms of page turning? Or
I think it's a totally syllogistic argument that, you know, that we need the carrot. You've already granted that you're dumbing the thing down for some carrot-needing reader. I'm not interested in that reader. I'm interested in writing at the highest levels of literary art. I'm not interested in reaching I'm interested in consciousness, in thought, in I mean, to me, your argument is self-defeating to me in the sense that you're saying, oh, doesn't the reader need a carrot? Wow, that's a pretty lowbrow argument. I mean, that's really, not lowbrow, but it's like, wow, that's defining the novel in pretty humble terms. And the works, all I can say is the works I love the most, you know, whether it's Proust or Tristram Shandy or Moby Dick or Elizabeth Costello or the Camus' The Fall or Marguerite Duras's The Lover, that whatever books they are that are quasi-novels, the entire energy of the work is essentially meditative. They're wrestling with some enormous psychological and societal conundrum, and that just interests me more. That rivets me more, and I'm trying to provide the aesthetic framework for like-minded readers and writers.
But what a fun. I mean, it's fun to turn pages, at least for me. I don't see any harm in, if you're going to advocate mashup culture and things like the Grey Album, it seems to me that highbrow, lowbrow, this kind of thing would fit within that particular spectrum. I mean, I love Sarah Waters' books, which are absolute page turners.
And they also the elephant thing?
Huh?
Sarah Waters, is she the water for elephants?
No, not Sarah Grant, you're thinking of. But Sarah Waters, Fingersmith, Tipping the Velvet, The Night Watch.
Don't know, what did you call them, sort of mysteries? Or
They're sort of like a kind of historical novels that reveal lesbian relationships and gay relationships in ways that have permitted, I think, people to know that they existed before our more permissive times. And I think there are insights in there, but it's also, if you read Fingersmith, if you have any sense of what you call the lowbrow novel, you're flipping the pages maniacally. I mean, you know, I'm the kind of guy who read Against the Day and read that thing in 2 days because it was fun. I mean, you know, I don't see what's so wrong about fun along those lines. I don't even see what's so, you may call it childish, but I have no problem being a child.
Childlike. Yeah. I wouldn't say childish, childlike. But, I mean, I guess I love books. Like, I guess there's a line of Cynthia Ozick's, I think I quoted in the book, where she says that I don't find entertainment entertaining. Like, again, I'm not saying I'm right or I'm not saying I'm wrong. I'm just saying this is my aesthetic. I'm fine with, I find David Markson unbelievably riveting. Like, to me,
so
he's a total page-turner for me. Like, I could no more put Markson down than other people could not put down Grisham or whatever. And so I'm interested in works that, for me, have this quality where everything stops and, you know, you are walking downtown and all you're doing is reading the book as you're walking or you're on the subway or whatever. Or, you know, but for me, those narrative, the moment I'm inside a narrative machine, my aesthetic is such that I tend I'm all for being riveted. I'm all for turning pages. Page-turning novel, for me, is dead-on arrival. The moment it's making that gesture, I feel the writer's orientation is to hold me by the hand and entertain me and tell me a story. And I simply am not held by that. I'm held by a writer trying to solve being alive. That's what I find genuinely riveting. Any work that I find truly serious has that as a virtually overt subject matter. It's about nothing less and nothing more than that. And I just love work that is what I call about what it's about. So many writers, they develop this narrative and they think that what the work is about will sort of sneak up through the cracks of the narrative. And obviously there are some exceptions, but in general, I'm not riveted by riveting novels. I'm just deeply bored. Like, for some reason, a good example for me is always The Great Gatsby, who the first chapter I adore. I just love hearing Nick Carraway talk about money and class and place. It's thrilling. And then this unbelievably cornball plot starts on chapter two, and I literally can't read it. I mean, of course, I read it in high school and college as required, but I go back and reread it, and I just so love that voice of Nick Carraway slash Gatsby, slash Fitzgerald, just thinking about the Midwest and the Northeast and class and money, et cetera, et cetera. It's great. And then for me, all the intelligence drains out of it. I find maybe I'll try and find this one passage which goes heavily to all this, if I can. This really gathers a lot of what we're talking about. I'll find it. But anyway, I don't know if we need to turn off the tape or anything, but it's really a nice passage which I've sort of ripped off from a friend of mine, and he insisted that I not quote him because he really hated any sense of citation, but it's a really beautiful passage, so I feel comfortable saying it's great just because it comes from my friend Michael, but I'll find it in a second. I think it'll help trigger our discussion into other realms. Let's see if I can find it. I don't know how conversant you are with the book, but it ends with this thing about Lou Reed and, you know...
What was it, the Metal Machine God reference?
And, you know, kill your band, and it goes to that. That's the ending, and it's the ending of a chapter, and it's kind of... And then I go to No More Masters, No More Masterpieces, and I'm just not finding it... It'll come up in a second for us, but I just thought if I read it, it'll trigger some thoughts for us, maybe. Let's see.
It was where they basically say, well, we don't know what his reasons were, whether
exactly.
It was bullshit or
exactly.
Whether it
Precisely.
Was...
Exactly.
Whether he did it because...
And maybe it's earlier than I remember.
I think it's actually fairly early in the book.
Is it? It's definitely the end of a chapter, that much I know. And it's on the left side of the page.
Yeah, it is on the left side of the page. I remember that.
We'll find it, but I think it might... gather some stuff for us. Because I was trying to think of who...
Is it in the remix chapter?
I thought it might be, but I don't think so. Let's see. It might be. No. It's weird. Where would it end? Maybe it is later than we're thinking. Yeah, I think it might be later. Okay, there it is. It's on 149 and 150. Perhaps I'll read this aloud if I could, Edward. It might help frame our discussion. I say, plot isn't a tool. Intelligence is. I don't derive meaning from intellect, but from the illumination it pries out of unmediated experience. Though nonfiction has as much, quote, fiction in it as fiction does, its aims are different. The mediation between writer and reader is thinner. Serious nonfiction removes fiction's mask, stripping away monuments to civilization to arrive at truths that destroy the writer and thereby encompass the reader. The last shred of human expression before silence seizes all words. The novelist invents a story to highlight his craft. To a younger reader, stylistic bravura is a revelation of the imaginative life, but to the mature adult, craft per se isn't revelatory, merely a demonstration of cultural refinement and a parable of the power of storytelling, all in the interest of proclaiming the writer and artist. Fiction mimics interest, God's intelligence, intelligent omnipotence. There's a plan, plot, no matter the story's tragedy. The most horrific story is softened by the author's presence, seeking, no matter how faintly, to educate us on the limits of disorder held together by the civilizing process of creation. Lyric essay tells a story at a baser level, irrational, plotless, characterless, or repetitiously characterized. It informs by serial enactments of the mind's processes prior to writing the story. The goal isn't to get to the point of wanting to write the story or fulfilling society's need for it to be fictionalized. The goal is to bear the elements not as narrative but as life. Serious essay, disallowing the writer the privileged position of living only in his head, unravels within life's chaos, confirming the chaos. Fiction seeks eternal rationality. The burden shouldn't be for me to find myself in the work of the great fiction writer. He seeks to escape his head by allowing me in through exegesis, a game that pretends to reward the best chess players. I prefer essayistic impulse. Violently bumping up against the other at the flash point of instinctual reaction. I don't want to be inside the fiction writer's head unless he first agrees to kill his characters. After two decades of playing rock and roll, Lou Reed put out an album of white noise called Metal Machine Music. Could be brilliant, could be bullshit, to get himself out of a record contract to a label he hated. But it's become influential. The advice in his liner notes, kill your band. So anyway, that's a long passage, and thanks for indulging me. I didn't know if that triggers any further thoughts or questions from you.
Well, actually, I did want to ask you about the hyperfake. You have one quote in this, hyperfake is a way to get an essence of real, exactly reminiscent in all these ways of porn. But to that, I would add, you know, J.G. Ballard's High Rise, the Gormenghast books, The City in the City by China Miéville, all create worlds with which to learn more about the human condition and to present almost an alternative to our own universe with which to examine the real that we so inhabit. I don't view any of those books as pornographic. I view them more as enthralling, and I view them, in fact, perhaps as more enabling of the digression. So I'm curious about why you would compare, say, a hyperfake world designed to get closer to reality or truth as porn.
Well, it's not. I mean, I definitely. Do you have a section number for that?
That is.
It doesn't really matter. No, I mean, I definitely did mean to, you know. I mean, I'm interested in porn, both...
Aren't we all?
...sexually and aesthetically. It's really terribly interesting to me. But, yeah, I mean, I was just sort of making a point about the hyper-real and its how porn is interesting and its hyper-reality and its quasi-documentary qualities are incredibly interesting, in which tiny fluctuations of feeling play onto the characters' faces occasionally, and it's unbelievably interesting. But I wasn't trying to equate fiction as a kind of pornography. I mean, I was just sort of making a point how the hyper-real and porn are intimately related. I mean, all I can say is that for me, when we enter, and there are exceptions, you know, and there are books that tend to have a high dose of consciousness, say Thomas Bernhard or, you know, Camus, Coetzee, Marguerite Duras, people like that. but to me, the moment it has a fictional frame, like a truly fictional frame, it feels to me like a very safe space. I feel like, I mean, again, it might be my aesthetic prejudice. I'm lacking the story gene or the fictional gene or the fact that both of my parents were journalists and I have this deep non-fictional gene in me that's really kind of almost in a strange way, kind of anti-imagination, almost like Plato wanting to banish the poets. I mean, I realize there's part of me that feels a little bit Philistine in my weariness with the imaginative realm. But for apparently some fellow travelers, when it has this fictional frame around it, it's overtly saying, don't worry, kids, it's all just a show. God, the temperature in the room falls precipitously for me. It's like, really? That's so boring. I mean, why? This is our one chance to communicate from human to human. and you're going to insist on this sort of fictional frame. All I can say is, for me, the temperature in the room falls. I'm really interested in, like, for instance, I love, for as an example, like, I love D.H. Lawrence's studies in classical American literature. Tells me hugely more about Lawrence than any of Lawrence's unbelievably tedious novels. I mean, I'm interested. What happens to you doesn't interest me greatly. What you think about what happened to you interests me greatly. So to the degree the work is foregrounding almost exclusively consciousness, I'm up for it. And some of those books happen to be novels. Proust, Musil, some Virginia Woolf. But to the degree that consciousness is not the absolute center of the text, I tend to find the work very domesticated, quite safe, easily placed behind a proscenium, and all I can say is that I'm bored. The risk element seems pretty low for me.
But what would be an example, or can you cite an example of consciousness, this commitment to consciousness, merging itself with story or narrative or truth? I mean, one might say that David Markson's books have a certain kind of narrative thread, particularly, what's the one? I believe it's Writer's Block that ends with, you know, author has cancer. So there actually is a narrative. Wittgenstein's Mistress has a narrative, too, when we have the final reveal near the end. Is that an acceptable compromise for you, or is it not even a consideration?
Well, for me, maybe this is totally unfair, but I don't think of Markson's books as even remotely novelistic. I mean, to me, their energy is completely essayistic, and they're just like Sebald is miscategorized as a fiction writer. To the degree Sebald interests me, he's essentially an essayist. He just is. You know, I mean, the energy of the work is somebody thinking about his life from a relatively unmediated perspective. And, yeah, of course, there are fictional elements, but there are fictional elements in all book-length essay. And I have a whole argument about that if you want to hear it. But Markson is an interesting case. I mean, I love Markson's work. I definitely think that there's tremendous emotional and thematic and psychic momentum. A good example for me is This Is Not a Novel. To me, maybe one of Markson's best books. I mean, I love the last four books. I like Wittgenstein's Mistress less, because for me it's too plotted. But I love This Is Not a Novel, Reader's Block, the last novel, and Vanishing Point a lot. And This Is Not a Novel to me is a really carefully braided meditation on a very specific question. To what consolation do we ascribe timeless art, given the fact that we all die? That's what that book's about, absolutely, without question. Every single passage is building toward that one idea. That's the energy of the book. That thrills me. I find that absolutely riveting. And it's really exciting. And of course, there are fictional elements, the character called author, etc., or novelist, whatever he's called. But the energy of the book is intellectual and psychic. It's the plot is the most trivial throwaway, like if a character has cancer or whatever. It's just a book that's to me a great example of all this is J.M. Coetzee's Elizabeth Costello. I just love that book a lot, and that book to me solves the problem beautifully. There's a fictional character named Elizabeth Costello. A lot of the lectures are versions of lectures Coetzee gave. And yet the book is a sustained meditation in which Coetzee/Costello are trying to figure out what in life can they affirm. Each chapter by chapter, to me, eviscerates a previous affirmation that Coetzee had offered in previous books. And finally, by the end of the book, the only thing that Coetzee and Costello can affirm is the belling of frogs trapped in mud, just sheer animal existence. And that's pretty close to Coetzee's position, I think. And it's a really thrilling book to find out. Again, he's trying to solve being alive. Like, what is it about existence I can affirm? You know, not love, not sex, not politics, not art, not justice, not, it's just the belling of frogs. You know, I find that thrilling.
I also wanted to ask you, you write about listening to a National Gallery tour guide declaring that Rothko was great because he forced artists who came after him to change how they thought about painting. And you then write, this is the single most useful definition of artistic greatness that you've ever encountered.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, what about an inferior artist? Say, an artist reads a book that is particularly bad and is then committed to this higher plane of literature. By that token, say, Grisham, for example, might be considered a great artist because he was the one who caused the artist to become greater and not fall within this trap. I mean, you know, I'm just curious.
I'm not sure I follow.
Well, okay. An artist who forces artists to change how they think about their art, that could apply to a lesser artist or an inferior artist as well as a great artist.
I see what you mean. Like someone who's like a really horrible writer,
yeah,
might read Grisham or whoever, or even like a semi-bad writer, like, say, I don't know, whoever, Louis Auchincloss or whoever. I mean, just someone who's just a hack or whatever. I mean, I don't know. I've read almost none of him. Maybe he's better than that. But, you know, someone who's sort of like, I mean, Grisham is such an easy target. It seems sort of ridiculous. But, you know, someone who's okay, like... I don't know, I can't think of someone off the top of my head, but, you know, it's like a good, solid, like, what's his name? The guy who wrote those novels set in Washington, D.C.
Pelicanos?
No, not him. Anyway, it doesn't really matter, but it'll come to me in a second. But anyway, your point is well taken that on a practical level, of course, the most god-awful work could influence hundreds, if not thousands, or even millions of people. I'm sure that probably thousands of lawyers have taken up their pen trying to write novels based on Grisham. But all I can say is, yeah, of course, on a practical level, just like I argued that reality TV is interesting when, in fact, reality TV really isn't all that interesting, and it's just an economic consideration based on the fact that it's cheaper to produce reality TV than it is to produce, you know, The Sopranos, so...
Or The Wire, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so, no joke. So on some level, there's just a practical fact. I mean, for me, I'm interested in huge artistic movements, and John Grisham, you know, in no way has anything to do with the motion of the history of art. And whereas Rothko, I mean, obviously, to take him as an example, that he, you know, he altered the weather after Rothko, as among... many other people, but it would be impossible to think about figuration the same way after Rothko had shown what you could do with abstraction. So he would force every single writer after, every single painter after him, to think through that. Whereas John Grisham, he might influence someone to write a book set in, you know, the Mississippi Delta or whatever, but I don't know, on some basic level, he's not changing anything to do with the form of art. I mean, in the sense that John Grisham writes the way that probably people wrote Potboilers in 1934, just kind of a story. I don't see how he would influence the shape of artistic form in any way, because his thing is, in fact, a return to something that would happen 100 years ago, probably. I mean, so that he couldn't... He's just writing like a little bit of a mystery or a thriller a la, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, but not as great as Poe, so... I don't see how, in any real sense, he's all... You know, that wonderful phrase of Pauline Kael about Bertolucci's Last Tango in Paris, she said, you know, it altered the face of an art form. That's the highest praise you can... Rothko did that. Bertolucci did that. You know, the work I love and try to aspire to does that. You want to alter the face of an art form so people can't go back to what was before.
On the other hand, I'm going to give you an example. David Foster Wallace, he... very much liked how Tom Clancy explained things. We'll have to look at the Ransom Archive, but whether that had any kind of impact on the sheer level of detail that is in A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, that wonderful Cruise essay, perhaps there was a connection there. Perhaps that was the inferior artist giving a great artist permission to produce greatness.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure Wallace was kidding when he said that. I mean... You know, he has that list where they ask, I forget in what context, they ask various people, I think there's this really odd book, they asked various writers, you know, what are your 10 favorite books? And Wallace listed, you know, 10 horrible books. And I think Clancy was number one. So it's crucial, I mean, for David Wallace's work that nothing he says is not cased in amazing caskets of irony. And so it's crucial, in my view, that he was joking about that. I don't know the full context of it, but I know in this list of his 10 favorite books, he lists 10 horrible books, and at the top of the list is Clancy. And Wallace is so invested in pushing back against commercial and advertising culture that art is a gift, commercial culture always wants something from you. He's very, very adamant about that, or was, and I think it's hugely tongue-in-cheek on Wallace's part.
Anthony Burgess set out to write an airport novel and then produced Earthly Powers, which is this mammoth collection of data and names and the like. So that's another example to sort of back up this idea that great art can possibly come from an inferior artist. And that's, I mean, I clearly have more of a love between the meshing of high and low than you do.
Well, I love a lot of so-called low work. In fact, I think of this book as an attempt to, I hope, demolish those categories among other categories. I mean, so many of the works I point to are pretty so-called popular. Like, I love, you know, a lot of people who have hugely influenced me are pretty popular. Like, I love Chris Rock, I love Eric Bogosian, Rick Reynolds, Dennis Leary, Sandra Bernhard, Spalding Gray, Sarah Silverman. I mean, I love a lot of relatively popular filmmakers like McAvoy and Morris and Wiseman, and trying to think of a popular writer I really love. Not coming hugely to mind off the top of my head, but I mean, I love Larry David a lot, you know, and so I don't have a sense of like I only love the most austere stuff, because my aesthetic doesn't exactly go that way. But yeah, I don't have this thing like, oh, I have my nose in the air, I hope, and I only love, you know, Proust and, you know, whatever. I'm not really like that. I mean, I love fantastic work, and some of the work I love is really severe, and some of it is pretty pop. I mean, I love voice and consciousness and thought, and I love work. It's almost just across the board. And it sounds sort of corny, and it comes from an interview between Amy Hempel and Gordon Lish in Vanity Fair, December 84. Like, and Lish says, you know, the work should try to solve being alive. I find that a bottomlessly useful term, that I love work, whether it's Chris Rock or it's Proust, they're both doing the same thing to me. They're trying to show you how they solve being alive. I love work that gestures, like for instance, Wallace. I mean, this is sort of truly verboten to say, I guess, but to me, his two books of essays just dwarf the fiction that he wrote. I mean, to me, Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again and Consider It a Lobster are, you know, far, far and away Wallace's best work. You know, I find his novels very, very tough sledding, and a couple stories I like. But Wallace's work that I love to death and that I've read each, you know, at least 10 times are the books of essays.
What are your thoughts on Ulysses while we're at it?
Ulysses?
Yeah.
It interests me. I mean, I haven't reread Ulysses for a long time, but I think it's important to read Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake. I mean, Joyce said famously, and I quote him in the book, I'm quite content to go down to posterity as a scissors and paste man. Great line. I love that line. And that's Joyce, you know, the modernist literary hero. You know, I think of those books as just endless books of pastiche and quotation. I mean, Ulysses is, I guess, a novel. The parts that interest me the most are just sheer kind of wordsmithery or whatever. I mean, I just love just getting lost in, you know, a page of Finnegan's Wake, you know, or whatever, and just watching the language play out as sheer verbal tempest. I mean, Joyce is not absolutely central to my aesthetic. I'm not really sort of, Proust is more, why are you asking? Just because I'm sort of demolishing various icons.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm just curious.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love Wallace's work. I love the nonfiction, which it was a shame. I should have written something when he died, which is say, like, everyone, in my view, is totally missing the boat. I mean, do people truly think Infinite Jest is a great novel? I mean, in no way is that a great novel. I mean, it just... everything he wants to accomplish in Infinite Jest, he accomplishes in shipping out, you know, in a supposedly fun thing, in that title essay. It's all there in that essay for me. I mean, everything he wants to get to, he gets to in 40 pages in my view, a supposedly fun thing.
Not even the form of the endnotes appeals to you in Infinite Jest? Or?
Well, yeah, that I like, but I mean, he does those, and he does those in supposedly fun thing. I mean, I must admit I gave up finally on Infinite Jest. I haven't read all of it. I vowed to read it, the whole thing, at some point, but...
How far did you get?
I read about maybe two-fifths of it, of the novel, and then I started to read a lot. I read some of the endnotes a lot, just as sheer... just the play of it. But anyway, I'm just talking about my own readerly experience, and I'm just trying to trust my own nerve endings. I'm not, again, it seems incumbent upon me to say, like, I'm not really interested in creating some new literary hierarchy whereby I don't really care where David Wallace is ranked or who, but I'm just saying at a very, very, very visceral level for me and for a lot of people I know, that Wallace's essays are the immemorial art and the novels aren't. I mean, I'm trying to say stuff that, you know, I think a lot of what writing is about is saying what you're not supposed to say. And so part of it is incumbent upon me to say what you're not supposed to say. You know, there was an LA Times review that said something like, you know, it was positive, qualified positive review, but she said something like, you know, it was a nice thing. I mean, it's not like I'm quoting from like a rave review or anything, but she just said something like, it's about time someone was this honest in print or something like that. And, you know, I mean, that matters to me to try to be candid, to get beyond layer after layer of received wisdom. So, yeah, I mean, that's my actual experience of David Foster Wallace's work. The essays are genuinely thrilling and the novels are not.
Well, the other thing, too, is that you have that letter to Walter. This is what set Laura Miller off in her review.
To William, yeah.
To William, I'm
what
sorry.
What did she say? I didn't
well,
finish the
scene. Well, she basically started saying that how could you advocate the Catherine Harrison book while simultaneously saying that, you know, I would never, ever read the corrections if my life depended upon it. I think she just detected a certain contradiction there, which then caused her to, and actually it also caused Sam Anderson of New York Magazine to be set off as well. I mean, when you say an extraordinary thing like that, basically saying, on one hand, you should read this Catherine Harrison book, but on the other hand, I'm not going to go ahead and read this Franzen book, even my life depended upon it. There is a contradiction there.
Namely what?
Well, that you'll advocate one book to read and you'll say, well, I feel this way about this book even though I haven't actually read it and will never read it. There's a certain inconsistency there. I mean, it's if you had even read, like, I presume you haven't read a single page of that Franzen book.
Oh, yeah, I did.
Okay. Okay. So how much of it did you read?
I read about 125 pages. Because, you know, it was getting so much attention 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I was sick, and I was sort of enjoying it as just a book to curl up with in bed. You know, it was sort of enjoying it, and then I just realized, you know, just on a fundamental human level, like how deeply uninterested I was. That you're supposed to care what happens to these characters, and I just realized I think my guard was down because I had the flu or something, and so I was just sort of reading and kind of enjoying what seemed to me the old-fashioned pleasures of it. And then something happened where I guess that I got over the flu and my brain came back into play, and I just felt like it's just on a fundamental human adult level, it's just deeply uninteresting to me. He's a carnival barker. He's there to entertain. He's there to move me through the pages. And that there's, I mean, it's a really heartbreaking thing for me because I do think the book is about or wanted to be about something quite interesting, namely the idea that families and societies and markets overcorrect, and that this whole idea of correction interests me a lot on an emotional level and a societal level. But the book does not put any real pressure on those ideas. It's an intellectual patina to give the book the illusion of intellectual seriousness so that he can sort of get in bed with Wallace at all. But really, it's essentially a, you know, it seemed like a well-told pretty old-fashioned sort of family album with a patina of intellectual seriousness, and I just found myself ultimately like deeply offended by its lip service it gives to ideas and real thoughts, and its true investment in, you know, good old-fashioned novelistic storytelling. And it just, for me, apparently lacking the novel gene, it's like, I get it. It's a dry hustle. There's no real ideas here, are there? It's just a patina. I felt deeply offended and I put it down.
When I was young, I never needed anyone. And making love was just for fun. Those days are gone. Living alone, I think of all the friends I've known. But when I dial the telephone, nobody's home.